to get to know you. If you would like to be recognized, just say your name. Anyone? Any newcomers? Okay. Is there anyone needs phone numbers? Okay. In keeping with our seventh tradition, we state there are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contribution. And I think the basket is already went, because I see it right there, filled with money. But I'm gonna still read the announcements. If your birthday is coming up, please... This thing is weird. This looks like a part of a shower. I don't know if you're talking or taking a shower here. Anyway. Oh, right. Tell me about it. If your birthday is coming up, please see chairperson without the chair in the direction or the direction on the birthday board about birthday silver dollars, which is that's the board. The bulletin board in the large room contains information on temporary sponsor lives and finding a sponsor, having your anniversary posted in the intergroup, requirements for chairing a meeting at the central group, and that's the bulletin board. Our group conscious meeting is the first Sunday of the month, immediately following the 10 a.m. meeting. If you park at a dentist next door or any other area in the parking lot not designated for parking, you will be told. After the meeting, please move to the rear of the building, picnic tables, and avoid using loud language out of courtesy to our neighbors. AA literature can be purchased at the coffee bar, and there's a free brochures available in the corner. I don't know what happened here. Okay, there we go. I'm sorry, my son is sick and I've been sleepwalking after him. So I'm a little out of it. But hey, briefly qualify. How about that? Right on time. At this time, chairperson should briefly qualify. Requirements for the chairing a meeting at Central Orlando Group Saturday night speaker meeting is 1 year of continuous sobriety and attendance at the group conscious meeting. And by the grace of God and the court system, I've been here, right? I wouldn't say I was drugged here kicking and screaming, but I was transported to treatment from jail. So I don't run away, I guess. I wasn't planning to. I was pregnant. Last thing I want is running, but anyway, I am sober today, thanks, you know, to my kids, my higher power, which I sometimes feel I'm falling off my rails, and like today, but I'm sober, and I'm just, you know, I'm meeting all the requirements, and thank God I'm here, and look at packed house. So there, that's it. The group asked me to remind you, please make sure your phones are off and refrain from moving around or talking while speaker sharing. And our speaker tonight is my really long, long, long time friend in sobriety. He was my roommate for a while in treatment. But I guess you'll know that, you'll hear about that later. And her name is Kathy. Please welcome.
Hi, everybody. My name is Kathy. I'm an alcoholic.
Kathy.
And, let's see. I'm here to tell what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I am just an average alcoholic, just like any alcoholic of our type. And I am so grateful to finally be able to admit that and get sober. Let's see. Let me get started. Let's see. I am the middle of three girls, and my parents were divorced when I was about 6 years old, and one of the earliest memories I have are of being with my sisters and my parents and just feeling really happy. And then one of the next memories I have are of my parents getting divorced. And so I think I started out young, like feeling like I wasn't getting what I wanted. And so I'm really nervous. So, you know, a lot of my early childhood was spent like feeling angry, but I don't even think I know why I was feeling angry. My dad tells me stories about getting into fights at the bus stops, and I remember my best friend like breaking up with me and getting a new best friend because she said all I did was criticize people. So I think that was one of my early forms of trying to feel good about myself, was putting everybody else down. I meant to start out a little bit by saying that that I do come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I do have a desire to stop drinking. I do have a problem with alcohol, but there were lots of drugs in my story too. And at one part of when I first came to AA, I remember that I wouldn't say I was an alcoholic. And then there was another time where I felt like that AA might not let me in if they knew my story, you know, but now I've just come to the point where I just don't think that's true. You know, when I look at my drinking, it was nothing but alcoholic. When I read in the big book that alcohol in any form, you know, that when I started mixing sedatives with my alcohol, things really fell apart. So I'm grateful to be in AA and to feel like I belong in AA too. And so there, I said that part. And because I think that's important. But I also have, you know, come to the point where when I'm in the meeting, I say, hi, my name is Kathy, I'm an alcoholic. I don't say I'm a drug addict anymore in an AA meeting. My sponsor told me that. So there I was, this young girl, and I was very mean to everybody. I had this anger thing going on. And when I was in the third grade, I was 8 years old, and I used to spend a lot of time over at my friend's house. And her family went to church every Sunday. So one day I heard in that Baptist church that if you ask God to come into your heart, that he will come into your heart. So I went home this particular day, and I got on my knees in my room, and I prayed, God, please come into my heart, come into my heart. And then I waited for something to happen, but I didn't feel anything happen. And so at that young age of 8, I came to the conclusion that either that's not real, what they say, or it just doesn't work for me. So, you know, already I was kind of like, well, I tried that. That's not real, or it doesn't apply to me. So I was growing up. My first drink, I lived with my dad when my parents got divorced. I had stepmothers that I never got along with. I had this good friend in about the seventh, eighth grade, and she would go visit her dad and come back with like a mayonnaise jar filled up with some kamikaze out of her dad's liquor cabinet, and we would just shoot that, and, you know, I would ride my bike home, weaving all over the place, and, you know, so that was my early experience with drinking. There was a time when I was in eighth or ninth grade where I was really unhappy at home with my dad, and I was getting drunk before school and staggering around the hallways, and I got called into the dean's office, but the dean was dating my best friend's mom, and he knew my dad, so he said, well, you know, I can't call your dad, because he was, my dad was kind of a jerk back then, I think. And some people knew that too. So, he let me go home with my best friend's mom. But they sent me to the guidance counselor, and I remember her trying to help me. And that I just wasn't very responsive. You know, along the way, in retrospect, I see where people tried to help me, but I wouldn't let them help me. I don't know why. So then what? Then when I was about 15, I ran away and lived with my mom and stepdad, who were like the opposite of my mom's house. My dad's house. My dad's house was very strict. My mom's house was like wild, you know, smoking pot in the bathroom. My stepdad would give me pills and beer and all that. So it was just the complete opposite. And so I remember living with my mom and kind of getting a real clear sense that this really isn't right. I really should be getting more parenting than this. I can see that. But once again, rather than, you know, I would see what the right thing would be, but I wouldn't do the right thing. I would just use the fact that things were going wrong to go along with the wrong, right? So that's what I did. And like I said, that was my mom and stepdad, and we spent a lot of holiday, or it was a household like I would imagine is just the typical dysfunctional alcoholic household. You know, it was holidays with the stepdad in jail. There were the phone calls from store owners. Could you please come pick up your mother? She's intoxicated in front of our store. There was just a lot of dysfunction. And like I said, I just remember that point in my life being one where I just said, oh, well, I guess this is my lot in life or what I'm worth. And I just kind of went downhill. So when I turned 18 and I got ready to move out from my parents' house with my mom and stepdad, I remember thinking that I just didn't want to be like them. I just didn't want my life to be like that, that I wanted to be good, and I wanted things to be good and normal. And which is kind of funny, because even though that was my mission, I was doing the same things they were doing, but expecting for the same thing not to happen to me, just because I didn't want it to be the same. So then what? Let's see. Okay, so that was my goal, was to not be like my mom. And so when I started working, and I worked in a law office, and I started dating one of the attorneys there, and I remember thinking that that was a really good thing. Like, see, I'm not like my mom. You know, there would come times where I would think, see, I'm not like my mom, and I can solve these problems. And if I don't think about the bad things that have happened in my life, they don't affect me. And you know, kind of like, I don't know, just kind of like in Bill's story where he says, when there was a problem, I could solve it. I could take care of it. I could do whatever it took and it would go away. So when I got to this point, I was about, I don't know, 25 or so. So I started dating this guy, and we would go to parties, and everybody would be drinking. It seemed like everybody was drinking the same as me at these parties. But I remember that guy saying to me, you know, I really don't appreciate the way you act at parties. I mean, I would come out of the bathroom and, you know, whoever was there, I don't know how to describe that. I had I would just, like, be so drunk that I would not even know what I was doing, right? I would turn into this free spirit, you know. I would always find someone else that was like me to hang out with so I could justify what I was doing. And like it says, I was reading Bill's story today, so like it says in Bill's story, when Lois would say to him, you know, she started complaining about his drinking, right? But he would tell her, it's okay, I'm all right. And that's what I did. And so then I ended up getting married. And when I got married, and we had two sons, and I lived in this nice house, worked in a nice office, had these two nice sons, and that was kind of like me. I remember just kind of saying, there, see, I got that thing I was looking for. I reached my goal. I'm not like my mom, and my life is good. So then I started, then I stayed home. I quit working, and I was staying home, and I couldn't understand why, but I just started getting very depressed. And I think what happened was that all the stuff that I just kept pushing down, just started coming up because now I was at home and there was, you know, it just started coming up, but I didn't know what was happening. So, once again, you know, my husband started asking me, is there anything I can do for you? Do you want to go back to school? Do you want to do this? You know, offering me help. But I would say, no, I would find a reason not to do anything that he suggested. And I just kept feeling more depressed. So then, I need to speed this up. Let's see. So then, I was talking to my next door neighbor one day, and he had some drugs, so I started doing the drugs, and that was it. I just remember thinking, oh man, what a relief this is. I don't feel depressed anymore. This stuff is great. And the more that I kept doing that stuff, the less I was acting the way that I would like to have been acting. You know, the more that I was doing that stuff with the next door neighbor, the more, you know, started doing with the next door neighbor. And, and the more I started, I don't know, it just felt like everything was messed up now. Like now I'm, it's just like it says in the book. I couldn't tell what was true. I couldn't tell. Everything was just coated with the drugs and the drinking. And I just kept doing it more and more. So my husband sent me to a therapist to kind of roll this along. I went to the therapist. She suggested that I go to Betty Ford. I was like, you gotta be kidding if you think I'm going there. I ended up going to Betty Ford. While I was there, I had what I think of as a spiritual experience for the first time. And it came in the middle of family week, sitting across from my husband there in the family circle. But it was just a sudden feeling. I think because I was just scared to death, and they were teaching us things about God and higher power there while I was there. So I had this, well, I call that like an introduction. That was my introduction to God, because while I was sitting there, I just got this sudden, it felt like a wash, like just this overwhelming feeling that everything is okay. Like when your best friend is with you, when you're, you know, like in the eighth grade, and your best friend is with you, and everything's going to be okay. But I left there, but I still didn't know what to do. I was so new in recovery, and when, you know, the first thing that didn't go right, I was off drinking again. So then I got sent to residential treatment. I was divorced over the phone in residential treatment. That was no fun. I was not allowed to see my kids, and it just felt like my whole world was ending. So I was in that residential treatment for 10 months. I got out. I remember getting out and thinking, now I don't have to go back to those AA meetings because nobody's making me anymore. And then I got that slight feeling like, but things were going really well while I was going to those AA meetings in treatment. But still, you know, the other thought won out. And, you know, I really didn't have a problem with drinking. It was the other stuff that was the problem. And I'm starting to feel lonely. And so I started drinking. So to cut that short, I ended up being taken back to court like over and over again, not allowed, you know, what's it called? Order to terminate all contact with those kids. And so I got to the point where the way it describes it in the book is, something happened that didn't turn out my way, and so I blamed God for that. I was making these demands that if you're real, God, and you love me, you'll fix my life with those and let me see my kids, you know. And if it didn't, then that was it. I wasn't going to do it. So there came a point where I was just very angry, and I just said, you know, forget it. And I'll just go with whatever comes along. So, you know, what came along was another guy who did drugs and drank the way that I did. And so I started in with that. Another thing that it seemed to me at that time was that the reason things were going so badly was because I wasn't getting to be a mom. So I also, so while I was with that guy, I decided that I should have another child, that was going to fix everything. And it didn't. What happened then? It was just your typical, progression of alcoholism and drug addiction. That's what was happening to me. You know, things that I couldn't imagine that I would ever do, I was doing all over the place, you know. Everything I said was a lie. I got a DUI at that time, and I got that DUI because I was in a blackout and I sideswiped a police car and did not even know it. And, all I remember is stopping at a stoplight and rolling down my window and the officer saying, "You mean you don't remember hitting the police car, Miss Shannon?" "No, sir. If I would have known, I would have stopped." You know, so step out of the car. And what else happened during that time? Let's see. Okay, so now here I was. I'm in another house with my daughter and with another, you know, with her father, and I'm not allowed to see my sons. And now my daughter's father started saying, "If you don't stop, I'm gonna take you to court too, and you won't be allowed to see your daughter either." So I went back to treatment. That's where I met Elena. With that time, I spent like 15 more months in treatment that time. And I know when I would get into treatment, I would get sober in treatment. But it was never my idea to go. And it was always like this tug of war, like, I know what they're telling me, but I don't really feel it, you know? I hope I get it this time, too, as much as anybody else hopes I get it. You know, but I don't know. I just couldn't. And I would go through that treatment, and then I would get out, and then the first thing that would happen, I would go back out. So that's what happened this time, too. I was in that residential treatment. I was just about to graduate, and I told my daughter's father that if I come out of treatment, you're going to have to stop drinking so I can try to stay sober this time. And when he said no, I just used that as an excuse that, oh, well. I remember having the thought that I should call my sponsor. Oh my God, what do I do? I had the thought to go do that, to go drink. What do I do? Oh, I know, I should call my sponsor. And I picked up the phone, but then within a minute, I hung up. And then off I went. And it was just with a vengeance this time. Because I think, like, I knew that it couldn't last, because I had seen it not last so many times before. So now I was just like all out, no holds barred, and I was crazy. I was stealing everything that I could find. I one time left my daughter at home in the crib while I, you know, thought I could run out and be back in 20 minutes. And while I was out, I was pulled over by the police, and they said, after this, just this long detainment. And then finally they said, put your hands behind your back, you're going. And I just thought, oh my God, what am I going to do? You know, my daughter's at home. Well, and then I don't know how I got out of that, but they let me go. And one of my first thoughts after they let me go is, oh well, I guess I can't go to that area anymore. I mean, you know, that's so messed up. And, and like I said, I was stealing everything. I was writing books of bad checks and thinking, oh, well, I know this is going to get me in jail. I know it is for a fact, but I guess I don't care because I, you know. And, so what happened? So there I was. I was called to court now. Now I had this court date to go about my daughter. And it was in front of the same judge as I had been going to all these years for those little boys of mine. And I weighed about, 95 pounds maybe. I looked just pretty disgusting. I remember thinking, I can't go. But at the same time, I can't not go. So what was I going to do? What was I going to do? You know? Okay, I'll go, but I'll have to be messed up while I go. You know? I'll go. And I remember having things in my purse that I for sure was going to get me arrested, but they didn't find it in my purse. And I showed up in front of that judge, and he just shook his head at me. And, I don't know, just that look on his face and my being there, and I was court ordered out of that house too. And so then I finally at least got the idea at that point that, okay, I need to just stop trying to get sober. I need to just like go all out in the opposite direction. So I just went that way, and I just went until I could not go anymore. I mean, I was like hanging out on the street. I was walking. I don't know. It was just weird. And so then what happened? Okay, so yeah. So then I was staying at this apartment of a friend of mine. And I just remember having this moment at about 5 o'clock in the morning when I could just see everything very clearly. That this, what it was right now, not being allowed to see any children, living on the street, not knowing what to do, not having worked in a really long time, it was either I was going to go to OBT or something. I don't know what I was going to do. But I just remember having the thought that I just can't do this anymore. And for the first time, I don't think I want to do this anymore. And so I came to a meeting here at Central, and it was a Sunday morning, and I went to the meeting, and then at the Burning Desires, I raised my hand, and the chairperson pointed at me and said, "Kathy." And I was like, "Oh, that's weird. How does that girl know my name?" So after the meeting, she walked up to me and she said, "Do you remember me?" And I was like, "No." And she said, "Are you sure? Are you sure you don't remember me?" And she went on, like, I mean, I had the thought that I'm going to punch her if she doesn't tell me. And, you know, I must have stolen something from her. That's must be what's going on. So, but as it turns out, she was the judge's assistant that I had just been before, like about 2 weeks prior to that. And so, you know, and that was weird to have, like, it just right at that moment, it just seemed like the judge was in front of me, you know, my sons were in front of me, my daughter was in front of me. Like, what is that doing here? You know, and she said, "I've been right where you are, Kathy, and I can help you if you'll let me. I've read your file. I know everything about you." And for the first time, I believed somebody who said that. Because up to that point, with everybody telling you, "What are you doing? You need to get sober. You need to stop what you're doing." But nobody was telling me, "I understand how it feels," you know? Or maybe they were, and I just couldn't hear them. I don't know. But for the first time, all I know is that I actually believed her. And so she told me to meet her once a week. And, she didn't ask anything else from me, just to meet her here at Central once a week and to do some things out of the book. And we would read out of the book. Oh, and I didn't have anywhere to stay, remember? So my choice was to go stay at the Salvation Army down the street. And for a fleeting moment, I thought, "I'm not staying there." And then suddenly, you know, some reasonableness kicked in. And I was like, "Do you hear what you're saying? Go stay there," you know? So for the first time, I went and I stayed there. As soon as I would wake up, I would come running down here to Central and just hang out here during the day. I just remember feeling like I don't know what else to do. I don't know what's going to become of me. But I would meet my sponsor here once a week, and we would read out of the book, and we would work those steps. And then from there, I went to Wayne Dench Center. I stayed there. I remember finally being able to, like, put my kids to the side, kind of, just long enough to meet her once a week and to, you know, ride my bike and get a job and take the bus and to just keep putting one foot in front of the other. That's how it felt. Like, "I don't know how I'm doing this, but God, if you just help me keep doing this." And that's what I did. And I got this little job, and what was I doing? I was going to meetings at the greenhouse. I was coming here. I was living at Wayne Dench. And she had me send cards to my sons every week, like a card once a week, saying, "How are you? Mommy's fine. Here's $5. I love you." That was it. And just to move into that, start giving instead of complaining about what I'm not getting, instead of just taking from everybody, just start giving on a small scale. And so I did that. I remember crying a lot, feeling like really sick and tired of crying so much, but at least being willing to do it anyway. I remember working the steps and being surprised at each one, at the effect that it was having on me, you know, that I never knew that before. And I could just see it working. It was true what they said. that that there was no direct assault required by me, you know, to go back to court and to do all that stuff. I could, you know, stop blaming everybody else, and I could see my part in it. I could offer to help. And when I started doing those things, I started getting some things. You know, I started getting visitation with my kids, and I got a job from someone in recovery. And I still have that job. That was in December of 2004. And I remember when I moved into my first place, I was unpacking a box and I found some stuff in there. And I just remember being shocked as anything that I literally held the box out, like recoiled as though from a hot flame, and calling my landlord, who is in recovery, and calling him. He came up and got the box, and then I remember feeling like a feeling of confusion, like, what am I doing? What do you mean you just gave it away? You know, I mean, it was a very strange phenomenon to be doing that for the first time ever, you know, and then I remember my landlord took the box away and then came back up, and I said, now what'd you do with that? You didn't just go throw that in the trash can where I'm going to be down there at midnight, did you? You got to get rid of that stuff, you know? So he said, oh, I'll be right back. And, you know, so that's how that went. And then, you know, and then as I worked through the steps, you know, if for the first time ever, I knew where, you know, I mean, of course you know where the drink is, but, you know, knowing where the other stuff was too, and not going to get any. You know, I remember feeling like I couldn't move, I couldn't get out of bed, but if I drank a couple of beers in the morning, I not only could I get out of bed, I was singing to the radio on the way into work. You know, but now I did not need to do that to get out of bed. What else? At one point, since I've been sober, I was having something going on with my left eye, and I was going to the doctor, and finally I was diagnosed with having a brain aneurysm, and I had had that for like 3 weeks, so I had to go in for surgery for that, and I do remember being at the place where they do the x-rays and everything, and them telling me, you need to go straight to the hospital, they're waiting for you, you're going to have surgery. And having the thought of, well, maybe I should stop and get something first. You know, like just kind of a recognition that this is what I would do if I weren't sober. Well, I'll do it, but I'm going to have to be really messed up to do that, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense, you know. And I could, that's how, kind of how it's been going, is I can see what I used to do, and I can see how it doesn't make sense. But whereas before, you know, I was under that strange and powerful spell that I couldn't see outside of, you know, from working the steps, like it says in the book, I can think about it, I can, all that, but I don't have to do it. And my life is going a whole lot differently because of that. You know, I always wanted to be happy, and I couldn't figure out why I couldn't get that way. And I learned in here that if I do, by doing the right things, that's how I feel happy. Not by just insisting that I feel happy somehow. I know that, you know, that from the beginning, I've always wanted to be a good parent, and that one, you know, the thing where it says in the book that you can't give away what you don't have. So I know that I could, I don't think I would ever be able to be the parent that I would want to be, because I didn't have anything to give to my kids. But now, that's one of my favorite parts about recovery, is that I get to learn things that I get to show them. And, it's really strange speaking, so you think it's going to go so much differently than it does. I guess I could close, because since it's birthday night, with the fact that, you know, that I just never knew that this life existed. I didn't know that it could be so good being sober. I didn't know that there was a different way. And the only way that I've gotten to know that is by doing it. It's kind of like that catch-22. You can't know until you do it. But now that I have done it, now I know what it's like and how good it is. You know, I always thought that I couldn't be without the drinking. I just never got beyond that. Stop drinking. Oh no, I can't. That was as far as I ever got. But that's just not true. Well, I guess that's it.
Thank you, Kathy.